This is Line One, Your Health Connection, a weekly program produced at the studios of KSKA. Each week, KSKA's host, Dr. Thad Woodard, puts you in touch with local and national experts in a variety of health and family issues. Opinions expressed are those of the host, guest, and callers, and do not represent those of KSKA, the licensee, or the underwriters. Here's your host, Dr. Thad Woodard.
Good afternoon. Welcome once again to Line One, Your Health Connection. Our topic today is complementary and alternative medicine, and with me in the studio is Dr. Lynn Freeman. Dr. Freeman is a psychologist who is the founder of an organization called Mind Matters Research. In addition, she's the author of a recently finished third edition of the college textbook, Complementary and Alternative Medicine, a Research-Based Approach. She's also teaching in mind-body medicine throughout the state. And is a researcher, and one of the reasons for the program is to discuss her research. And also joining us by telephone is her mentor and a true expert in this area, Dr. Lorenzo Cohen. He is at the University of Texas MD Anderson Cancer Center in Houston, where he's director of the Integrative Medicine Program and chief of the Section of Integrative Medicine in the Department of Palliative Care and Rehabilitation Medicine. Welcome to each of you from all of us at Line One.
Welcome, Thad. Thank you.
What we're going to do today is I'm going to start by just asking Lynn to talk to us a little bit about what she does in current research for a couple of reasons. We want to see some of the detail it takes and some of the heartache about getting good research done. We'll talk about that at some length and then move on into the broader section, the broader idea of mind-body research and integrative medicine. So, Lynn, why don't you tell us a little bit maybe about Mind-Body Matters Research and then your current research.
Okay. Mind Matters Research is a woman-owned small business here in Anchorage that performs mind-body research. And from that research, we develop intervention programs to mitigate or help to overcome what's called the late-term and long-term effects of cancer treatment. Right now, we're working specifically with breast cancer, but we also work with other forms of cancer or will be working with them in the future.
And the this is all led, or this organization is the is how you go about doing the research that you're doing.
Yes, exactly. In Alaska, we don't have what you would call any extensive work around clinical trials for mind-body medicine. So if you want to do that kind of research here and if you want to make a good argument for getting funded, you need to have a good team of people and you need to have an organization that's approved for that purpose. So I actually set out in 2002 to set up Mind Matters Research. And since I was paying the bills and working a regular job during that time on my part-time, it took me 2 years to meet all of the assurances and set everything up to become essentially a research center. And I will mention that even as a small business, you still have to meet all the same criteria that a university would meet. So we set that up, and in 2004, I applied for a Phase 1 study. And that was funded. We were fortunate and ran that research in 2005.
What do you mean Phase 1? Since we're going to talk about Phase 2, let's make sure we make sure people understand what that means.
Well, let's talk a little bit about what a clinical research really is. NIH defines a clinical trial as a prospective biomedical or behavioral research study of human subjects that's designed to answer specific questions about biomedical and behavioral interventions. And, of course, the clinical trials are used to determine if those interventions are safe and if they're effective. And you do that in stages. Typically, a phase one study is anywhere from 20 to 80 people. And you're looking to see if the study, first and foremost, is it safe and can you deliver it? And then also you're looking to see if your preliminary results show some benefit as opposed to making sure it's not causing harm. When you go to a phase two, now phase ones typically they can either have a control group or not. In my case, they didn't for phase one. It was simply looking at the pre and post outcomes. For phase two, you go above the 80 number. It can go up into several hundred people. Our current phase two study has 135 as the mark that we want to meet. However, as I say that, I'll mention that we're looking at two supplementals right now, hoping to increase that number to 165 to 180. So then in those studies, you have a control group where you compare outcomes. In our study, we use what's called waitlist control so that you have the control group, but you can also actually train the people who served as your controls at a later point. So they're not denied the treatment. And the goal of our particular program is to work with what's called the late-term and long-term effects of cancer care. So what that means is that sometimes the treatments that save your life, and they're wonderful care, and when you go through your conventional treatment, your surgery, radiation, chemotherapy, you may do only one of those, you may do all three of those. But the Institute of Medicine identified some time ago that sometimes there are what we call late-term and long-term effects of those treatments. And those can include things like, like chemo brain, which is what patients call it, which essentially refers to cognitive deficits. Also, there can be issues of fatigue, of sleep deprivation, you're not sleeping well. Stress, both could be from the diagnosis, from the treatments, and also from coping with the effects later, anxiety or depression. So individuals may have none of these after a period of time. They may have one or all. And it's very helpful, though, to be aware that these are symptoms that can occur and to have a strategy for trying to overcome these and to go beyond them as quickly as possible. National Cancer Institute is committed both to the best treatments to save people's lives and also to then improving the quality of their life to the optimal level after the treatments are completed. So that's what our program does.
And you're looking at imagery specifically to see if you can ameliorate in a scientific way some of the long-term effects, if I'm understanding.
Exactly.
And let's define imagery.
Well, a way to think about imagery is simply engaging the imagination specifically to modify outcomes, and those outcomes could be physiological or biochemical or mental or emotional. In this program, that means for us that we intentionally integrate all of the senses, sight, sound, odor, touch, and taste, plus emotion, plus the imagination, to significantly improve the quality of life. And what we mean by improving the quality of life is reducing some of those long-term and late-term effects.
Dr. Cohen, I want to try to get you in this, and maybe a way to do that now would be to talk about the importance of a control group. And then Lynn was talking about it. She's in this phase two study, 135 participants, trying to get that number a little bit higher. Why are the numbers important as well?
Well, control groups are critical to really understand whether what is being tested in the experiment is better than doing nothing at all. So we know, for example, just the simple passage of time for women after breast cancer treatment is over, the primary treatment, that just the passage of time, the further you get away from radiotherapy and surgery and side effects of chemotherapy, that there will be improvements in women's quality of life. By and large, if you look at a group of women, their quality of life overall will improve. Some, of course, may stay the same, or some may get worse if symptoms get worse for an individual person. But in general, that's what you will see happen. So in the phase one study that Dr. Freeman conducted, there were dramatic improvements that were seen in patients' quality of life. And the size of the improvements was such that you wouldn't expect those dramatic changes just by the passage of time alone. However, you can't exclude that possibility. Mm-hmm. So it's very important to be able to have a group that's compared to, and that group can either be doing nothing, as is the case in the phase two study, or in many trials that we're familiar with from the drug world, is the use of placebo, where the patients think they're getting the treatment, but in fact they're getting an inert substance.
Mm-hmm.
So that's really why it's critical for control groups, and we can talk about this in more detail later on, but there's a particular challenge in doing this type of mind-body research to have what we would call placebo-based control groups. But in this case, in the phase two portion of a study, a usual care control group is perfectly acceptable, or the waitlist control group who will get it eventually.
Yeah.
So the other question about the number
right.
of patients, when a study is too small, you run the risk of having a a sample that may not be representative of the general population that you're trying to study. So if you're to recruit just 20 or 30 patients, those 20 or 30 may not represent the larger group of women with breast cancer. And so you want to get a sizable portion so you have, again, enough representation. Okay. And it also will increase your ability to find an effect, to see whether the treatment produces a meaningful difference. And there's a lot of statistics that go into that aspect of it. But with more patients, it's more convincing at the end of the study that the findings are real.
Yeah, I think of it as it's the more you have, the more and the greater that difference between the two groups, the more likely that's not happening by chance alone. Is that a fair and easy way to say that thing?
Yeah, exactly.
All right. Let me take a second and let everybody know who's listening how they can get in touch with us today if they have questions or comments, both about what you're listening to as far as the research and the whole issue of alternative and complementary medicine, or any experiences that you may have had as well. We're going to be talking about the research at the beginning, and then we'll talk about more general aspects of researching in to cancer chemotherapy or cancers with complementary and alternative medicine as we get into the program. But you can reach us locally by calling 550-8433, 550-8433. We have a toll-free number, 1-888-353-5752. And emailing at line1 and spell it out, LINEONE, all one word, at kska.org. And please remember this program is live between 2 and 3 Anchorage time locally. It repeats from 8 to 9 each evening. So if you want to make any comments or ask any questions or send us an email, you need to do it between 2 and 3. And you can always go back and see the interview or listen to the podcast by going to kska.org, where we also have some links to, we think, may be beneficial for this program. A couple of questions come to my mind. It seems like we're a relatively small state, so and getting big numbers might be difficult. Breast cancer is one of the fairly more common. Are you having trouble? And is that one of the big frustrations that's been trying to accomplish to get going in this study?
Well, that actually has two different answers. For the size of our state and what we'd even expected to get, we already have exceeded that. Dr. Woodard, we have 82 people that have asked to be on study. Now, that doesn't mean all of them will be qualified when we go and check, but we were expecting to have at least 60 here. I actually set up my design based on the concern we wouldn't get enough people here so that we're doing part of it here and part of it in Seattle.
Okay.
Because Seattle has one of the largest breast cancer populations in the country. But, of course, this being my home state, I wanted to make sure that people here who wanted to be involved in the study had the first opportunity to do that. So we are still recruiting here. We could take another 30, 40 people to probably get to probably about 95 people that would be actually qualified.
Do you want to mention how people who might think they would like to be on the study, how they can find out if they're a candidate or not?
Yes. Actually, what they would do is they could either call our office, which is 868-7737, or they can email us at mindmattersresearch.com, B.L. Freeman at mindmattersresearch.com. And what happens is they would just email or call and say, I'm a breast cancer survivor, I have an interest in your study and would like to be considered to be on study. And what happens next is that I do about a 10-minute pre-screening phone call with folks. And that's because, you know, if we're pretty sure that they're not going to be eligible, we don't want them to have to go through the paperwork and all of that. So we spend about 10 minutes talking about it, where I also explain the time commitment. Doing mind-body practice is sort of like when you would take a good medication, Dr. Woodard. If you had the best medicine in the world and you didn't take it, it wouldn't help you a lot. So we have to talk about the time commitment for them to practice, and we also look to make sure they're eligible. An eligible criteria pretty much is that you are a breast cancer survivor, you are in fact experiencing what you described to us as some of the late-term and long-term effects, and then we have a few questions to rule out that this might be from some other cause.
Another question that comes up in my mind is in the general area of confounding variables, and confounding variables are other things that happen during a study that have to be taken into account. And one of these, if you're talking about a medication treatment, then you have to be sure that the medication is right and which dose you're using, and there's some effects, similar things like that. In this, it seems like there's going to be some variables in how imagery is done, how it's trained, who does the training, for what time of day. Tell us a little bit about the critical variables in doing effective imagery training.
Well, actually, it's that very issue and the confounding variables and the misrepresentation sometimes of outcome that led me to do this study. To do good imagery practice, it has to be first taught by people that are trained to teach it well, that know how to help persons identify what's called passive imagery that can be modified to improve health outcomes. It has to be taught consistently, and you have to teach it in a way that helps persons to feel self-empowered and motivated to practice. And then you have to actually document the level of practice, because, again, if persons are not practicing and you're not documenting that, you could show no effect at all, and it might mean nothing about the program because they never practiced it. So all of those things are built in. We have trainers that are trained in this, that are certified by Mind Matters Research to do the training. We have training manuals. It's manualized, so we're teaching the same information in the same consistent fashion class after class. Persons fill out forms for us that they arrive on their email each day. They fill out their practice sessions, hit a button, it's encrypted, it goes back to our database. We also do pre, mid, and post assessments. So it's important that you make sure that what you're teaching is consistent, that it's taught by qualified individuals, and that it's also that you're working with the person to help them modify their individual imagery. So passive imagery, which is that stuff we're swimming in every day that we're not necessarily paying attention to or trying to work with but has health impacts, that's what we're looking at modifying.
You know, good research is far, 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 far more difficult to do than almost even most professional physicians understand if they've never been involved in it. But tell us some of the difficulties, because you implied beforehand you not only had to go through some of the typical NIH requirements, there are other organizations involved in this, and each have their requirements, and those requirements are set up to make sure that they're spending their money on a very good product.
Exactly. There's certain things that we had to do, and the first thing you have to do, and NIH has a reason to be concerned that their money is spent well. So they want to see a good qualified team. And so in Alaska, the fact that we were not the most experienced people here, that's why I put together a good team of individuals who had much more experience than we did to begin with. And Dr. Cohen is our quality control monitor. His expertise, you know, is called upon repeatedly. And then he actually is coming here, for example, in July to inspect what we're doing and see how we're doing it. He advises on the grants, how we're functioning, the statistics, all aspects. So, and also Candace Pert, who is actually, she was NIH section chief for 15 years and the discoverer of receptors of neuropeptides, which is an emphasis of our study, since those are what are called the molecules of emotion, how you feel about things actually affects your biochemistry. She's actually working with us on the animations to assure that they're accurate. So you put together a good team of biostatisticians, quality control monitors, consultants, and then you make the best argument you can. And this grant is complicated in many ways more than most, because it is not only a clinical trial, it also is a technology grant, and it's an SBIR grant. And what that means is it's a small business innovation research. So we have a couple of different hoops we have to jump through that most clinical trials would not. They're funding us as a small business because the expectation is that if we get good outcomes, we will now make this program available across the nation, across to people who need it. So one of their goals here is not to just produce a good program, but to see that it's offered. So that required a whole series of commitments and documentation on our part to show how we would go about doing that. It's also a technology grant, and that also comes back to the idea of how do you deliver this at a distance. So we're teaching both live in the room and also using telemedicine equipment. We're comparing those two outcomes against each other. We're using Discovery Channel quality animations that are being created to help people use their imagination to an optimal level. My goodness, what else? We have the database that's encrypted and the website that Phase 1 participants asked for so that all information is available 24/7. So all of these pieces come together. You have to have the technology expertise and show that you can do that. You have to be able to deliver the program when the treatment is over, and you have to run a clinical trial. So it has a bit of complexity beyond just a typical clinical trial.
Remind our listeners, you're listening to Line 1, your health connection on KSKA. I'm Dr. Thad Woodard.
Stroke is an emergency. Providence, Alaska Medical Center is committed to increasing awareness of the symptoms of stroke if you or anyone you know has sudden weakness on one side of your body, sudden confusion, trouble speaking or understanding, sudden trouble seeing, walking, or loss of balance, or sudden severe headache without cause, call 911 and get to the hospital within 1 hour. Information at providence.org/Alaska. This message is sponsored by Providence, Alaska Medical Center.
This is Line 1. I'm your host, Dr. Thad Woodard, and today we're talking about some current research being done in Alaska and in Seattle on the survivors of breast cancer and how imaging might affect the ability of women to come through this disorder and treatment much more effectively. And my guest is Dr. Lynn Freeman, who is doing that research. And on the telephone is Dr. Lorenzo Cohen, an expert in this area from MD Anderson Hospital in Houston, Texas. Lynn, one more thing. When's the research is going to actually get underway? Can you predict that yet?
Oh, yes, I can tell you exactly. And, of course, part of this goes back to our culture. We are recruiting people now. We will be getting them approved to be in the study. And we'll continue to gather some folks over the summer. But as you know, in Alaska, Dr. Woodard, the last thing you'd want to do is ask people to show up on a Saturday for a class in the summer. Our actual pre-assessments and our trainings begin for the months of September and October. And then we do the same thing in the winter. We have a second group that begins, the actual training will be in February. So we're trying to plan the training part around portions that don't interfere with our opportunity for sunshine and to travel.
You know, to me, thinking ahead of time, and Dr. Cohen, I'm going to address this question to you. I've done limited amounts of research. I spend a reasonable amount of time reading about it and hopefully I can think about it a little bit. But just designing the study to do what you want it to do requires a lot of thought, forethought and understanding. And I suspect you had a big part to play in how this was all done and how the study was actually designed, how we're going to do it so that you know you have some good information when it's all said and done.
Well, Dr. Freeman has a lot of expertise and knowledge in this area, and although hasn't been doing a lot of clinical trial-based research, is very familiar with the field of mind-body medicine as a whole. And so it was relatively easy to be able to form the great collaboration that we've been doing now for a number of years. And the key that you really need to focus on is the measures. And part of this goes back to establishing a multidisciplinary team that includes the psychologists, but as well as the medical folks who need to be part of the team, and finding out and adding to that the partnership with breast cancer patients or the patient population that you're working with to find out what are the issues that are going on with people recovering from this disease. What are the obstacles that they are still encountering to have optimal health and well-being? And then looking at the particular intervention, trying to see what is it that you're hoping to modify in the patient population, and then seeing are there valid ways of measuring that. One of the faults that the conventional medical world will often have with this type of mind-body research is it's all relying on self-report, meaning that we simply ask the patients with questionnaires that are validated, but still just a questionnaire about how they're feeling or how they're doing physically. And it's not just one question. Unfortunately for the patients, it's often dozens and dozens of questions that we ask them. And we'll ask them in a slightly different way. So a measure of depression doesn't just ask, how depressed are you? But it'll ask about sadness and about fear and about loneliness, feeling unable to control one's life, all symptoms that relate to that one measurement that we would, at the end, add up and score and call depression. But something that's very important for mind-body research and that Dr. Friedman's been able to do in this study is also adding some what we would call more objective measures. So in the conventional world of medicine, we would call an objective measure something like cholesterol level that you would take from the blood, or measuring blood pressure that you as an individual can't necessarily aren't the one reporting that outcome. And so Dr. Freeman's been able to add some of these more objective measures that aren't going to be subject to bias just because the patient knows that they're in the imagery group and therefore they say their quality of life is better. So that's really where I think in the past decade we've seen huge strides in the area of mind-body medicine research, where we're seeing dramatic changes in objective measures as well as the subjective measures in terms of improvements when patients participate in these types of mind-body programs.
Okay, let me take a second just to remind our listeners again, if you've got questions or comments, 550-8433. Again, we're talking about complementary and alternative care, some of the research that goes on to it. And we have on the telephone Dr. Lorenzo Cohen from MD Anderson in Houston, who's an authority on this area, especially as it relates to cancer and cancer chemotherapy. Our outside number, 1-888-353-5752. And you can email at line1, L-I-N-E-O-N-E, at kska.org. Well, Dr. Cohen, tell us a little bit about what's going on at MD Anderson, both from a research standpoint, but I know you have an active treatment modality going on there as well.
Well, at MD Anderson, we have a very large integrative medicine program, and what integrative medicine really means is a... it's a relatively new field that in the past people would call alternative medicine and more recently complementary medicine. But integrative medicine is really about a new way of approaching caring for patients in a simplistic terms in a more holistic way. So we encourage patients, as all patients at MD Anderson, receive conventional treatments, chemotherapy, radiotherapy, or surgery, but then also to help guide them in incorporating some non-conventional practices that we know are safe and some effective alongside their conventional care. So within our clinical program, we're able to consult with patients on this whole area that would include mind-body practices, meditation, relaxation, yoga, qigong, Pilates, other movement-based therapies, art therapy, and other practices in that area. We have full-time acupuncturists on staff, and we know from a lot of research that acupuncture can help with symptom control, either due to the cancer itself or due to side effects of the conventional medicines. Massage therapists are here to work with patients for helping to manage symptom control. And then we have a program trying to educate people on appropriate diet and nutrition and when and how it's appropriate to use supplements or other natural products to help in the battle against cancer. At the same time as providing the clinical program, we also have very active research in all of those areas. My area of expertise is the area of mind-body, and multiple studies of different kinds of yogas, as I would call them, the yoga from the Indian tradition that is known as Hatha Yoga. We're looking at a form of Tibetan yoga as well as Qigong, which is a, we could call a kind of yoga coming out of the Chinese tradition. We also have active research in acupuncture, two studies in particular looking, one at pain control and one at peripheral neuropathy, which is the pain and tingling in the extremities as an unfortunate side effect of chemotherapy. And then a lot of research looking at natural products as potentially novel chemotherapeutic agents. It's surprising to some people to know that probably about half of the most commonly used drugs in our society today originally came from natural products or are based on the activity of a natural product. And when you look at cancer drugs, the number is even higher, upwards to 65% of the most commonly used chemotherapies coming from plants and natural products. So that's, it's very important to continue to explore the plant world as potential new treatments for cancer. Now, an important component of our program that could be of use and interest to the listeners is a website that we host to provide authoritative information on complementary and alternative medicine specifically for cancer. And that's accessible through the MD Anderson main portal at www.mdanderson.org and then /CIMER. And at this website, there's a lot of information on reviews of different therapies and safety issues and what the evidence is for different things, and really trying to help both patients as well as healthcare professionals navigate this very complicated world of alternative medicine for cancer care.
I would be quick to comment that also if the listeners did not get that email or that website, that we do have that on our website. There's a link directly to it as well as to Mind Matters Research, in the, which is Dr. Freeman's organization, into the National Center for Complementary and Alternative Medicine. Those three links are easily found. And one kind of environmental aside here, we've a couple of years ago interviewed a wonderful ethnobotanist. The ethnobotanist is a person who spent a lot of time in the Amazon trying to understand how shamans and others in that area have learned to use drugs from plants. And the really bad part of this whole thing is as the Amazon rainforest gets destroyed, it's estimated we're losing thousands and thousands of potential drugs each year. It's not just our CO2 that's getting affected by that. So the idea that we should be preserving all these this rainforest for further research into drugs is an important one as well. Let's see. How about imagery? Let me ask you about what we know about imagery. Well, let me back up. Now, before we get to imagery, how do we talk to me as a physician about how mind-body reacts? How do we know that there is some physical interaction going on between the mind and the body? What's the evidence for that that would substantiate that there is a mechanism with which we can really talk about mind-body interactions?
Well, frequently when people talk about that in a general sense, they look at what's called the HPA axis, which is how our emotions, our thoughts, and our feelings affect our physiology and biochemistry. You could think of it as the fight or flight response, the stress response. That's where it began. That's where you typically begin discussing it. And then the research in recent years has taken us way beyond that. In the textbook where I write about the research on imagery, they actually did a great deal more in the 70s than they've done lately. But some of that sort of pointed us in the right direction. It's easy to imagine. You can hook someone up, look at their blood pressure, have them do relaxing imagery, and you can show a reduction. And if they practice that enough over time, it will come down even throughout the day. I could throw a snake at you, and we could measure cortisol rhythms cortisol to see how what that looks like after you've been frightened for quite a period of time, and we'll see that going up. There's some interesting research actually with children as well as adults, and children are excellent practitioners of imagery because, as you can imagine, their imagination is very open and fluid to actually even affect the flow of certain immune cells in the body. We know from research that when people are terribly stressed, their natural killer cells, which is one of the things that fights cancer, begins to act not so well itself. People that are clinically depressed, their natural killer cells actually behave as if they're depressed. They're sort of sluggish. They don't work as well. So although you would not say, you know, having these effects can cause a particular disease, because I think there's a lot of people that can jump to that conclusion, and I would not be one of them. What you can say is that for optimal recovery, you certainly want to keep your physiology, your biochemistry, able to function as best it can. And that's one of the best places where imagery and other mind-body approaches can be most helpful.
Yeah, that's one of the thoughts that came to my mind, and I'd maybe like Dr. Cohen or yourself to comment on. I think there's You got to be careful when you talk about research to define what you're doing and put things in perspective and be very critical in your thinking, because people can jump to the wrong conclusions. If we're talking about cancer chemo or cancer,
yes,
we could – many people have already jumped to the conclusion that maybe alternative complementary care has been shown to be effective for active treatment or for prevention or for adjunctive treatment. But we're here talking about adjunctive kinds of issues.
That's what I'm speaking of, yeah. Yes.
Dr. Cohen, you want to follow through with that idea to make sure that we're clear on this? I think this is an area where it's very important, to, at least to me it is.
To everyone.
Well, then let me take a little step back and then we can take a step forward in that the things that we know about the mind-body connection, which has been demonstrated now over the past 50 years, is really how damaging psychological stress is to mm-hmm. our bodies and physiologically. And research really showing that, and a lot of this work originally done in animals, which is a model that you can control extremely effectively, that this chronic stress can be really deleterious to chronic diseases, and most importantly in animal models where the animals already have the disease. Now, when you switch into human beings, it becomes a lot more complicated, because there are a lot more differences from human being to human being than there are in lab rats, which are able to control all the genetic side of things. So when we look at these mind-body programs, although some people in the research world are looking at them as a way to increase length of life or to decrease the development of disease, what Dr. Freeman's doing and what we're doing at MD Anderson is more focused on patients' overall quality of life. At the same time, however, we are measuring biological outcomes and looking at the immune system. And the cumulative research today would suggest that people who are overly psychologically stressed around the time of diagnosis and moving into recovery do not do as well, both in terms of quality of life and in some cases in terms of longevity and response to treatment. And evolving research is showing in the biological mechanisms, again, where stress can mm-hmm. can literally get under your skin and into your cells and potentially decrease your chance at recovering from disease. Now, with that said, again, as I mentioned, there's a lot of variability from individual to individual, and different people can manage stress in different ways. Different people have different resources, different support environments. So it's not the same for all individuals. But again, we do know that stress can be very harmful, and there are ways to help relieve stress. And importantly, we know something like imagery is one particularly useful technique.
Give us some examples of specifically what you mean by imagery. Maybe all of us conjure up a slightly different idea.
Yeah.
You mentioned it, but what are you talking about when you think about imagery in this study particularly?
Well, let me tell you first what imagery is in general in day-to-day life, and then we'll talk about how it's used as an intervention. In day-to-day life, you are essentially swimming in what we call your passive imagery all day, Dr. Woodard. And what we mean by that is it's how you not only experience your life through the five senses, it's how you interpret it, it's how you respond to it, it's how you emotionally feel about what's happening to you. And all of those things have consequences and responses in the body. You know, they affect, obviously, blood pressure. Anyone who's highly stressed could have an elevated blood pressure. They affect cortisol rhythm and a variety of things. Passive imagery is sort of when we are stepping back and we are living that experience and we're letting just our consciousness run that show. We're not attempting to do anything about that particularly. when you look at imagery as an intervention, it's where you decide to get in the driver's seat a bit more. And therefore, you're going to step back and you're going to take a look at what that passive imagery is. That's one of the first things that we have persons in this study doing. They're looking at that story. They're constantly telling themselves about what's happening to their life. They're looking into their experience of that. And then they're deciding if they want to change the storyline. And they're deciding if they want to learn to engage the senses even more to do that. One of the things, for example, that happens when people are depressed, their senses will actually become dulled. They will find that colors don't seem as bright. Foods don't taste as good. They aren't as conscious, for example, of the beautiful nature sounds around them, these kinds of things. That's one indicator when I speak with patients when I'm doing a private practice about their symptoms. That's one of the things I look for. When you can reverse that and you actively engage your senses in ways that create healing stories, healing ways of viewing the world, it's sort of a self-fulfilling prophecy. You begin to become less stressed. You begin to actually find even more opportunities to do things better in your life. And it can help to mitigate many of the symptoms you have. Many people who've had chemotherapy have issues with memory afterwards. Well, it's no doubt, based on the studies that we have looked at, that we know that the chemotherapy does impact memory, but so does being stressed and unable to focus because of the stress or the sense of sadness. So we approach it from many different avenues. Now, it breaks down to, in the research, they talk about imagery in sort of three different basic categories. There's what you call diagnostic, which has to do with looking at that passive imagery and really finding out what is happening in your life and how that's working for you. It has to do with what you can call rehearsal imagery, mental rehearsal, childbirth, preparing for that, preparing for surgery if you're frightened by what's coming up. That's what you would call mental rehearsal. It puts you in more control, and you've worked through how you're going to respond to that. And then there's what you call end-state imagery. And end-state imagery is when you're trying to make a very specific change. In our study, for example, people will learn how to improve their heart rate variability. They'll work with imagery to do that, and they'll actually see that that happens. They'll work with controlling temperature in their fingers, and they'll see that that happens. So that's like end-state. You're actually deciding on a very specific thing you're going to do. And we have reasons for wanting to work with heart rate variability, which is an indicator of stress, and increasing temperature, since we know when you're stressed, your circulation isn't quite as good. So there are reasons for approaching it from end-state as well. So it's sort of like, depending on the outcome, they will assign a name to the type of imagery they're trying to produce.
Let me give our phone number once again. We're talking about complementary and alternative care. We're talking about some research that's being done to see if we can demonstrate that there's an improvement in the quality of life and outcome of individuals who have undergone cancer chemotherapy, particularly for breast cancer, with Dr. Lynn Freeman and Dr. Lorenzo Cohen. If you've got questions or comments or personal life experiences you'd like to share in Anchorage, you can dial 550-8433 and talk to us right now and ask your questions. Or you can also email lineone, L-I-N-E-O-N-E, at kska.org. Dr. Cohen, when I was listening to Lynn describe that, my thought was this is maybe, and this is where I want someone to straighten me out, it's almost like another form of psychotherapy, you know, somewhat like cognitive behavioral therapy, in that what we're trying to do is kind of change those mental mechanisms is not maybe the correct word. The mental pathways, if we think about how our neurons are interacting with each other and you know, get those moving in a different way, thinking in a different format, kind of changing how we're thinking and interpreting the world to better our outcome. Is that fair to say, or is there something more different about imagery?
I think, Dr. Woodward, that's an aspect of it, and in many forms of psychotherapy, and in particular in cognitive behavioral therapy, there is the use of imagery. But where it becomes quite different is it's not there as a way to, as we think of in conventional psychotherapy, to explore really the root of the problem. It's really trying to, during that period of time when you're engaging in the imagery, really to reset the way the brain is working. And ultimately that will have a cascading effect down on the body in terms of how the body is functioning, because ultimately the brain is controlling so much as we are. Often a top-down, and then, of course, the body reacting will send signals back up to the brain. And so in that sense, it's different. It's not delving into individual problems. And what's also unique about it is it's self-titrating. So people at different levels will go to different depths of what they're comfortable doing with their imagery. And so it's very much left to the individual to take it to whatever level they want. Now, in most of the research that's been done to date with imagery actually isn't taking as deep an approach as Dr. Freeman is, and that's what in particularly interested me in this collaboration. To date, and including some research that I've done that was recently published in a cancer journal, most people have worked with imagery in terms of getting people into a relaxed state by having them picture themselves somewhere else, i.e. close your eyes and picture yourself on a beach, and, you know, you engage the person to call on all their senses, the sights and sounds and smells and textures of that environment, to really have them feel that they're there, and therefore they'll become very relaxed, because you would always picture yourself in a calm, relaxing environment. And that research that's literally been decades going on has been shown to improve patients' quality of life, decrease physiological responding. Recent research of doing this kind of guided imagery during difficult medical procedures has demonstrated that the procedures are done faster, that there's less discomfort during the procedure, and in fact the hospitals save money by having somebody with the patient, having them go through this type of guided imagery. But what Dr. Freeman is doing goes beyond just that one type of imagery, and as she describes, there's other areas of imagery that can be engaged beyond just the picture yourself on the beach and getting relaxed. So that's sort of a long-winded answer to the question, but I would say that it's quite different from what we think of in terms of psychotherapy.
Okay.
I'd like to add to that for a second, Dr. Woodard. What we are doing is we're creating and teaching strategies that each person can learn, like a skill, that they can then engage, that empowers them to take more control of everything from the quality of their life to even their ability to improve their memory. We're working with the newest research on brain plasticity, for example, is how we're engaging this. So although it may have some beneficial psychotherapeutic outcomes that come with that, that is not what we're specifically looking at here. We're looking at providing skills. And you can think of that as like an athlete. You may very well know that imagery is used widely in the professional athletic community. One of my former students right now is working with an Olympic team to help them use imagery to improve their outcomes. So this is like that, except that we're working to improve health outcomes and quality of life.
Okay. We do have a caller. Margaret, you're on line one. What can we do for you?
Hi. I was wondering, is there somewhere here in Anchorage that a person could seek more information about this? This is so very interesting to me. I am a person that is highly stressed very easily. I have high blood pressure. I'm have been depressed for years, and I now am seeking help for all of this. And I just heard you on the radio, and I thought, oh my goodness, this is another form of help for people of many different, areas in life that they may need to improve. Right now, you're working with people. Is this concerning cancer patients?
Yes, it's for breast cancer patients specifically at this point, the study that we're doing.
Okay, but it sounds to me like this is a therapy that could be for many different things, correct?
You're right, and also I already have people approaching and asking how fast we're going to modify this for various treatments. What I can tell you is that Alaska Regional Hospital that sponsors our research, they are beginning to they're actually building, as we speak, a new cancer center support area to offer trainings on things like this. And it is we're expecting to offer modified versions of this, not as a clinical trial, but simply as classes this next year. So you might want to why don't you just simply leave information at my office, and we can make sure they get your name if you'd be interested in knowing more about that later. That's separate, okay, however, from this clinical study. I want to be really clear on that.
Okay, okay. That is wonderful. So it's providing skills for health.
Yes.
Okay. And the classes, and do I get the office address from somebody else?
Just go to KSKA.org/line1 and look at today's program, and there's a link to Dr. Freeman's webpage.
And that's Dr. Freeman?
Lynn Freeman, yep.
Oh, I'm excited about this. Thank you, Lynn.
You're most welcome.
Have a good day.
All right. Okay, you too. Bye.
Dr. Cohen, why is it important that this type of research be done?
Well, for a lot of different reasons. I think first and foremost is that there are a lot of people out there, and we just heard from one of them on the line, who are experiencing a lot of stress in their lives, and people diagnosed with cancer are undergo a profound amount of stress. There's the stress of our daily lives, and then you add on top of that a life-threatening illness that becomes quite a challenge to manage things. So it's incumbent upon us to come up with things that can be useful, and then to most importantly test them. And the challenge in this area is that there are so many things that our grandmothers know will be good for us, but in terms of the way science works, until it is proven effective, it's not something that can be formally recommended. So even though we know that guided imagery, the one that I described, just picturing yourself in a relaxed state in a different environment, has been shown to be useful, it still hasn't been incorporated as the standard of care. And so we really need to continue to do this kind of research to have enough accumulated information and showing the costs and the benefits for these types of things, where we ultimately can change the standard of care for patients. The other reason that it's really important to do this kind of research is actually just to, you know, the quest for knowledge and the quest for science and really the quest for understanding how human beings work and the really frontier type research in neuroscience right now is examining some of these questions that this type of research is tapping into. So when Dr. Freeman was talking about, you know, we're really trying to provide techniques and exercises for people to change ultimately the fundamental physiology of how their bodies work and ultimately how their brains are functioning. And we know that this is possible because of research looking at, for example, meditation, which incorporates many different kinds of imagery into a meditation practice, and seeing that meditation will actually change the way somebody's brain is functioning, and of course for the better, increasing synaptic functioning in parts of the brain that were previously dormant. And in particular, research showing that parts of the brain that are highly active during different types of meditation and arguably different forms of imagery are the exact parts of the brain that are damaged and downregulated as a side effect of chemotherapy. And so this type of research will actually provide information on the utility of this for breast cancer patients in particular, but it'll also be, I believe, somewhat generalizable to other cancer populations as well as to the population as a whole, even if you're not battling cancer.
There's we've actually only got about 3 minutes. This is always a very fast hour for me. And another big issue I'd like to maybe just have someone talk about just briefly is when we look at medicine, traditional medicine, and in this kinds of research, is it's one thing to show that something is effective. It's another thing, as you mentioned, to say this is the gold standard. And I think this is it appears the way Obama's team is trying to move is that we begin to look more at some of the comparative research to answer the question. Not does this effective, is this better than that, and in what situations would it be better than that? Do you have comments, either one of you, on this kind of movement towards on research?
I'm personally really happy to see the way the Obama administration is moving in this direction. For example, some of the stimulus funds we're looking at right now, Dr. Woodard, to increase the numbers here, to look at this study, those are going to be made available if those are forthcoming because of his support of that. And Dr. Cohen and I are actually looking at doing something even beyond phase two, which is to, after we've looked at imagery and its effects for breast cancer patients, then maybe compare that to meditation with breast cancer patients. Mm-hmm. Meditation frequently has very, you know, general goals that it wants to achieve. I'm trying very much to target specific areas. So it'd be interesting to see how that works right. When you compare them head to head. The other thing that I'm looking at doing here, and one of the reasons they funded the imagery program, is that other forms like meditation or hypnosis, depending on someone's religious tradition or their culture, that may not be comfortable for them. Whereas imagery, which is part of ceremony and ritual, pretty much is comfortable to any culture. And we found that we had, I think, 7 or 8 different religious traditions and indigenous people in phase one who were all comfortable with it. So you both have to find what's best, and you also have to find, however, what will people actually be willing to do? That's a critical piece of good treatment.
Oh, you mean you gotta have compliance and in this too, huh?
That's sort of important, yeah.
We got about a minute. Dr. Cohen, you have any final comments or thoughts?
Well, the key, I think, for trying to deal with these life-threatening illnesses and just stressful life in general is to engage in some type of mind-body practice, whether it's specifically imagery-based, which we know can be highly effective, or meditation or yoga, even spending time with friends and loved ones and getting yourself out of that stressful environment. People need to give their bodies a chance to relax and not be constantly bathed in the stress hormones, and it takes work, and it's not a simple pill that you can swallow, but the results will be quite profound if people start doing these types of interventions.
All right. Well, I want to express my thanks to both of you, Dr. Lorenzo Cohen joining us by telephone from MD Anderson, and Dr. Lynn Freeman, a local psychologist doing some active research in this area. So thanks very much.
You're most welcome.
Next week thank you. And next week we'll be discussing hepatitis and all aspects of hepatitis with one of the national experts, Dr. Brian McMahon of the Anchorage, Alaska Native Medical Center. So tune into your health and learn more next Monday, May 18th at 2 p.m., repeating the same evening at 8 p.m. on FM 91.1. For KSKA and for Line 1, this is Dr. Thad Woodard. Have a great day.
This has been Line 1, your health connection. If you have questions or comments concerning this program, write us at 3877 University Drive, Anchorage, Alaska, 99508, or email us at line1@ksKA.org. Additional information on today's show topic, including relevant website links, will be posted along with audio of today's program on our website at ksKA.org/line1. CD copies of this program can be purchased by calling 550-8400 during regular business hours. This is KSKA, Anchorage.